You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to our podcast series, Exploring Novel Targeted Treatment Strategies for Optimal Generalized Myasthenia Gravis Care. In this two-part podcast series, we'll focus on one of the newer treatment approaches to generalized myasthenia gravis, FcRn inhibitors. I am joined by Dr. Pushpa Narayanaswamy, a neuromuscular neurologist and expert. Dr. Narayanaswamy is the Vice Chair of Clinical Operations in the Department of Neurology at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston and a Professor of Neurology at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Narayanaswamy, welcome and thank you so much for joining our podcast.
Mel, thank you and thanks for having me today. It's exciting times for patients with myasthenia gravis. Always happy to talk about it.
Indeed. And let's start with those exciting times because the past 4 years have been exciting and encouraging for both clinicians and for patients living with generalized myasthenia gravis. Can you start by just giving us a quick rundown of the agents that are now available in the treatment arsenal for this condition?
Yeah, I mean, and this changes every day, right? Because there's so much going on in the field. So as of now, we have 6 drugs approved for generalized myasthenia gravis, and they fall into 2 main categories. The first category, and I'm going by the timeline in which they were approved, is the complement C5 inhibitors. And the second category is the neonatal Fc receptor blockers. So we have 3 agents as the complement C5 inhibitors. Eculizumab, that was first approved in 2017. That was the first new drug approved. Followed by ravulizumab, that was then approved in 2022, I believe. And then finally, we had zilucoplan, that was approved in 2023. And we had, in between the approval of these 3 complement inhibitors, we had the FcRn antagonist being approved. We had efgartigimod, that was approved in 2021. Rosinolixizumab, a mouthful, I often call rosinolixizumab rosy, approved in 2023. And nipocalimab, the newest kid on the block, just approved earlier this year. Now, obviously, there are other treatments that are in trials. Phase 3 trials have been published. They're close to approval, but these are the ones that are approved thus far.
All good and all exciting. And indeed, they are a mouthful to say each of these agents. So the focus of our podcasts are the FcRn antagonists or inhibitors, which is short, as you mentioned, for neonatal Fc receptor. Before we kind of delve into how these agents work, can you sort of take us back to our immunology 101 course and sort of explain and refresh us on how these receptors function in a healthy state?
Absolutely. And so, you know, you may first be wondering, what does a neonatal receptor have to do with myasthenia gravis or treatment in adults, right? It's sort of strange. It's actually very interesting. These receptors were first actually described in the placenta. And there, their function is to transfer immunoglobulin G or IgG from the mom's blood to the baby, to the fetus. And this happens around the 34th week of gestation, so the third trimester of gestation. So as you know, the baby's immune system when they're born is not fully developed and they cannot make their own antibodies. And so they need passive transfer of antibodies from the mother, which is why we immunize the mother during pregnancy so that it goes to the baby. And these receptors in the placenta are the ones that bind IgG from mom's side and transfer them to the baby, because as you know, most of these antibodies are IgG antibodies. So that's what they do. But then what happens otherwise? Well, you also know that unlike other immunoglobulins, IgM or IgA, IgG has the longest half-life in the blood. It lasts for about 4 weeks, about 28 days. And how does that happen? It happens through a mechanism of recycling it so that it doesn't get destroyed. And what is that recycling? And what does that have to do with FcRns? Well, the FcRn receptors are also found in the vascular endothelium, amongst other tissues. And the IgG in the blood can bind to these FcRn receptors. And once it binds to the FcRn receptors, it's internalized into the vascular endothelial cell in a round structure that's called the endosome. So the vascular endothelial membrane folds into the endosome. And the pH of the endosome internally is an acidic pH. As you know, the blood pH is alkaline pH. So in the acidic pH of the endosome, the immunoglobulin binds tightly, immunoglobulin G binds tightly to the FcRn receptors. And once it binds tightly, it does not get degraded in the lysosomes. Any of the IgG that does not get bound to the FcRn sort of goes away and gets degraded in the lysosomes. However, most of the IgG is still bound to the FcRn. The endosome circles back to the surface of the endothelial cell, and the membrane of the endosome fuses with the endothelial cell membrane, and now the whole endosome is exposed to the physiologic pH of blood, and in that pH, IgG dissociates from the FcRn receptor and goes back and is recycled into circulation. So that's what happens, you know, in the non-disease state in order to recycle IgG. So it's a good thing to have it because it makes the IgG antibodies last longer.
Thank you for that refresher. And indeed, it sounds like a good thing, a very complex thing. So it's amazing that we figured out exactly how all of this works. So now in a state of myasthenia gravis, an autoimmune disease, how do these FcRns function in the disease state? And just thinking about like the good thing that you just described in a healthy state, how is the inhibition of these receptors actually a good thing for patients with myasthenia gravis?
Great, and a really good question. So as you know, myasthenia gravis is a T-cell dependent B-cell mediated disease, and it's caused by autoantibodies that are most often directed towards the acetylcholine receptor, but can also be directed towards other receptors on the postsynaptic membrane at the neuromuscular junction, including MuSK receptor, muscle-specific kinase, LRP4, etc. So these are the antibodies that are associated with the pathogenesis of the disease. So it would be really nice to just get rid of those antibodies, wouldn't it? So obviously, one of the ways you would say you can treat the disease is to get rid of the antibodies. And we do that. We do plasma exchange to get rid of the antibodies. We just remove them physically, right? Now, what do the FcRn antagonists do? The FcRn antagonists are a group of drugs that have higher affinity for the FcRn receptor than does native IgG. So when you give patients FcRn antagonists, these drugs combine with the FcRn receptor, and so they stay combined or onto the receptor, and they do not allow native IgG in the circulation to combine with the receptor. What that means is all of the native IgG will then go, not all of it, but much of the native IgG will then go through the lysosomes and be degraded. So basically, you're reducing the total IgG levels. But what's in that IgG? The antibodies that are specific to the disease that you're thinking about, that is myasthenia gravis. So what are we doing? We are just destroying those antibodies instead of letting them recirculate back into the circulation. And that's how these drugs work in myasthenia gravis.
So how do the FcRn inhibitors that are approved, the three that you mentioned at the top of the podcast, that are approved to treat generalized myasthenia gravis differ? And do they have similar mechanisms of actions as we understand them?
Yes. So structurally, they're a little bit different. Efgartigimod, for instance, is a humanized Fc portion of IgG. So Fc portion is really the stem of that Y-shaped IgG molecule. Whereas both rosnilixizumab and nipocalimab are whole IgG4 molecules. They're a little bit different in that rosnilixizumab is a humanized molecule, whereas the nipocalimab is a fully humanized molecule. The mechanism of action is the same. The degree of reduction of total IgG differs a little bit. It varies anywhere from 60 to 80%, depending on the drug. How that influences clinical effect, we don't know. But it's out there, the data, that the degree of reduction is somewhat different between these three drugs. And they all act in the same way by removing the pathogenic antibodies.
Interesting. So you described like the role of native non-pathogenic IgG antibodies in a healthy state. And we now know that the FcRn inhibitors sort of gets rid of the good and the bad, if you want to term it that way in layman's terms. So do we know what happens to the levels of a patient's normal non-pathogenic IgG antibodies when they're on one of these antagonists?
Yes, we do. And these come from these healthy control studies of these drugs. And as I mentioned earlier, you have a reduction in the total IgG level in all patients or all people who are on these drugs. And the reduction can be anywhere from 60 to 80% from baseline. The reduction occurs, you know, about a couple of weeks after you start the medication or once you finish the course. Within a couple of weeks, the maximum reduction occurs. And then gradually, IgG, of course, is getting, you know, remade in the body. So the levels gradually rise. In about 8 weeks or so, 8 to 9 weeks, the levels come back to normal after you give them a course of treatment. Yes, it does drop the normal levels. And along with the normal IgG being reformed, of course, the antibodies get reformed too. And just one more comment, Mel, if I may. So we wonder then about the consequence of the reduction of this IgG level. And I think we'll be talking a little bit more about this, you know, when we discuss individual drugs and their the clinical trials. But one wonders whether reducing protective antibodies causes an increased risk of infection. That's the first thing that comes up to mind, right? And so that is something that remains a concern. And there are studies ongoing now looking at infection risk. There is some data from the randomized control trials and the open label trials about this. But that is the main concern. It's a little bit different. Now, there are people who don't make antibodies, right? They have immunodeficiencies, genetic disorders, where they are deficient in antibodies, in IgG or in several antibodies or several immunoglobulins. But this state, the FcRn state, is a little different. Because remember, we get rid of the antibodies, but the cells that make the antibodies are fine. That is why you regenerate the antibodies. But still, the concern remains that there is a time frame where the antibodies are well below normal and what happens to the infection risk in these patients.
Does the use of an FcRn inhibitor affect response to general immunizations as patients are on these drugs?
Again, very good question. So remember, as I said earlier, the machinery that forms the antibodies and therefore makes the antibodies in response to the immunizations is intact. So the body can still form it. But then you're taking away some of it that's formed. And so how much is the level at a given time? Is it enough to fight infections is the point, right? And so the recommendation at this time is to give people their immunizations, you know, a week before they're due for their next cycle. So the IgG levels have sort of come back, you know, close to normal or so. And at that time, immune system is capable of forming these antibodies. So around that time is when they recommend that that immunizations be given. There's some data. So in the ADAPT trial of efgartigimod, part of which was carried out during the COVID pandemic, we didn't do a systematic collection, but in whom the serum could be obtained looking for response to vaccinations, it did seem to be okay. In my own case, I had one patient, this has been published, who was pregnant. And of course, you know, we give them immunization. So I actually checked titers to rubella, to tetanus vaccine, etc. during the course of the pregnancy. She was always sort of, these titers are usually positive or negative. So it doesn't tell you the absolute titer. It's just positive means enough to protect, negative means not enough to protect, right? And so she pretty much remained in the positive range despite treatment, except for one time when her IgG was the lowest and her rubella titer became equivocal. So it seems like, you know, they do obviously mount a response, but they seem to have enough in the circulation to still protect it. But again, we don't have a lot of data.
So Dr. Narayana Swami, thank you for your thorough review of FcRn inhibitors and for the quick immunology refresher. I'm sure we all needed it. I look forward to discussing how these drugs are being applied to real-world practice in our next podcast. Thank you for listening to this podcast. We look forward to continuing our conversation with Dr. Narayana Swami and to you listening to the next installment. We also thank our supporters, Orgenex and UCB, which provided an educational grant for this CME-CE activity. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. In support of improving patient care, MedLearning Group is jointly accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education, and the American Nurses Credentialing Center to provide continuing education for the healthcare team. For more podcasts and other accredited activities, please visit us online at www.medlearninggroup.com.